cramp in my...
Cramp in your chin?
Chin.
The CMU Podcast, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, our review of the year 2016. It's the CMU Podcast! Looking back at the last year in the music business. It's our last podcast of the year. I'm Andy Malt. Here's Chris Cook. We're all ready to shun our usual format of looking back at the last week because absolutely nothing happened. Instead, we're going to look back at the last year.
The last year in music and the music business. Happy Christmas, everybody, because it is Christmas weekend as this podcast goes out. So if you're listening to it as soon as it's going online, or maybe you saved it for over Christmas lunch, happy Christmas, everybody!
Merry Christmas.
Of course, if you're coming to it a few days late, you'll be bored of people talking about Christmas, and we'll be heading towards the new year now.
Happy New Year!
Happy New Year, everybody. Happy Hogmanay. Of course, you're listening to this in the new year, because we're not coming back until the second week in January. Mm-hmm. I was going to hazard a guess as to what date the Friday might be, but I can't do that. Can't do the maths. But we're not going to be here for the first week in January, so therefore this podcast will be sitting in pride of place on the website all the way up till pretty much mid-January.
Yeah.
So some people will be bored of being told Happy New Year. So for those people, hello.
Just that.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So how's it doing? Yeah.
We're going to look back at the last 12 months in the music business and any hints on what that might include?
Well, it might include, well, by might, I mean will. People often say might when they mean will.
Do they?
Yeah.
Just then was the first time I've ever come across that, but I'll take your word for it.
Things like, I might go and get a cup of tea. You mean you're going
Oh, well, I'll say within that scenario. Yeah. Well, that's possibly because they're hoping that you'll say, actually, I'll go and make the teas. Perhaps that's then. It's just that you've never taken the hint. That is actually why people are saying might rather than will.
Look, if you want a cup of tea, just ask.
I would quite like a cup of coffee, but I think we've both agreed that the coffee machine here at the studio is beyond either of our capabilities because it's sort of one of those swish espresso / cappuccino machines, and I have no idea how to work it. So we're going to power through without caffeine.
We're going to power through this without any thought for our own safety.
We should say that we're recording this podcast slightly later in the day than we usually do. It's not there's no one in the building who would agree to make us a coffee, but most of the people we know who are usually in the building aren't around at the moment because we're doing this podcast a little bit later than we normally would. So, anyway, you were telling us what we're going to cover in this podcast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sorry. Without the lack of coffee, I was nodding off a bit.
So what might we be talking about?
We might / definitely will be talking about secondary ticketing, safe harbours, and we will also be looking at a few of the stories that have made us laugh in 2016.
Only one of which involved a pop star getting slashed in the face.
Surprisingly. You think there will be more? But first, streaming, which despite all efforts, remains a thing.
Whose sure. efforts?
I don't know.
So yes, the trend continued in 2016. It's been the trend for a few years now. Frankly, it's getting boring.
Yeah.
So let's hope in 2017, Spotify and Apple Music crash and burn and something new comes along.
We need a new format. Come on.
But for the last few years now, the trend in the recorded music industry has been that CDs are slowly declining. Although I'm sort of predicting that decline might speed up again in the next couple of years.
Do you think?
I think high street entertainment retail has had a few years of relative stability. After HMV's collapse and a lot of indie stores going out of business, we've seen a little bit of stability on the high street in the last few years, partly because of the vinyl revival, partly because they were sort of last man standing. And I think in the next few years now, we're going to see more indies go out of business. I think HMV's really going to downsize. But that's not what we're here to talk about. But for the last few years, physical has been slowly declining. CD has been slowly declining. Vinyl has been increasing, as we know. Downloads continue to tank. And of course, this year we had that week where vinyl sales outperformed download sales.
Yes.
Various reasons for that. But one key reason.
Sales revenues.
There's
a key word that you missed there.
Because vinyl's a lot more expensive than
digital. Yeah, because a lot more downloads were sold than vinyl, nearly three times.
It's just that lots of people were buying that 50 quid Kate Bush box set.
Yeah. And also people were buying vinyl as Christmas presents.
Yes.
And no one buys downloads as Christmas presents.
But crucially, during the iTunes boom, even with all of those provisos, that would never have happened. Whereas downloads are tanking and continue to tank, and it is all now about streaming. And of course, 2015, which we're not here to talk about, but 2015 was the first year in some time that the record industry worldwide went back into growth.
Yes.
So the 2000s was all about decline in recorded music. Then we had about 5 years of basically being flat. There was that 1 year where everyone got very excited because it was like 0.02% or something.
I think it was 0.002.
Which was probably a statistical anomaly. But in 2015, there was, it was still very low. It was like a couple of percent, but a little bit of growth. And obviously, we're yet to see the figures for 2016, but all the indications are the growth continued this year and actually slightly
widened.
Well,
Warner brought out some figures recently that were very positive.
Yes. So revenues continue to grow. And all of that is being led by the streaming revolution.
Mm.
It's all about the streams. And that's been the case for a few years now. But the streaming services are really coming into their own. But when we talk about streaming services, there are lots of streaming services. We could be here to talk about all of them. But really, when we're talking about growth in the recorded music market coming from streaming, we are talking about Spotify and Apple Music.
Yes.
In some of the Asian markets, there are some other services which are gaining traction. But really, worldwide, we're talking about those two services. And when we talk about Spotify, we're talking about Spotify Premium.
Yes.
Sorry, Spotify Freemium users.
You are not helping anyone grow anything.
In fact, you're a cost. Yeah. Every time you stream a track, you're costing the music industry money. Whereas if you're a premium user, you can take responsibility for allowing the record industry to go back into growth. So who knows, in a few years' time, when we get invited to parties in the music industry as journalists, we'll go back to having those stupidly extravagant, lavish major label parties that throw away loads of money. That hasn't happened in a while because there hasn't been enough money to throw away. But if you were to all sign up to Spotify or Apple Music over this Christmas break, the record industry can go back into really good growth and then we'll get invited to big parties again. And that would be good. So that would be nice.
Yeah, is that's
the conclusion?
That's the conclusion, is that we're just going to go to big money wasting. You think, I don't know, is that a good idea?
Well, I don't like parties, so I don't know why I'm talking this up. Sit-down dinners, though. I like sit-down dinners. So if
sit-down dinners where they give you way too much food.
So if it could
is that what you're hoping for?
Yeah, so if it could be guaranteed that once the record industry is back in growth, all the money gets wasted on sit-down dinners rather than coke-fueled beach parties, then I'm in for that, and I will be part of that. But, crucially, all the growth about Spotify and Apple Music, and the good news is, and one of the reasons why people are optimistic, is Spotify and Apple Music have had big years in terms of growing their users.
Yes, they have. As we've discussed before, I think Apple Music's growth is both impressive and not impressive.
Yes, depends how you look at it.
Yes, but Apple Music ends the year with 20 million subscribers, which, you know, is pretty good. It's just over a year old now.
Well, 18 months.
Coming
really, up
a year and a half, all right. Halfway to Spotify's 40 million, so not insignificant, although given that Apple Music is sitting on every iPhone in the world and being promoted, you would think they could get a few more.
Yeah, well, I mean, iTunes had something like 800 million people's credit card information, people who at some point have bought a download, whether it's music or film or app, off the iTunes store. And beyond the iTunes audience, which of course goes on multiple devices because people use iTunes on non-Apple devices, but then you have the entire iOS ecosystem, every iPhone, constantly pushing music at people. And anybody like myself who still uses their iPhone to listen to the old MP3 collection.
The what?
Technically an AAC collection, the music I download off iTunes. Every time I open up one of my MP3 albums, it's there saying, have you thought about signing up to Apple Music? And it's like, yes, I have, and I don't want it. Play me my album. So they have that massive marketing platform. So you could say, in that context, 20 million people's not a lot of people. But 20 million people in 18 months is still pretty
good. Well, as Eddie Q acknowledged recently,
Apple's Eddie Q,
the streaming market is still, while it is growing at a reasonably rapid pace, it's still a long way off, you know, being the mainstream, being the big thing.
Despite Daniel Ek insisting that Spotify was mainstreaming about, I would say, 18 months, 2 years ago now. I'm with Eddie on this, which is that streaming music, for a lot of people, the concept of streaming music at all is new, and the concept of paying for it is even newer for a big chunk of the market.
Yeah, and I think it's still a stretch. I mean, downloading was a stretch for a lot of people for a long time. And I would say for a lot of people, still is quite a stretch. And so streaming is yet another leap. And arguably, you could say if you got people on board with downloading, then you could get them on board with streaming. But then, as we've also discussed before, there's an issue with pricing of streaming services. And out there, £10 a month, £120 a year is actually just a bit too much for your average mainstream music consumer. Yeah. That's a lot more than they would ever have spent on music before.
In the CD age, yeah. So although the service is definitely worth that, if you want all of that music, most people don't want all of that music, and therefore it doesn't seem to add up. But I suppose the other interesting thing is Apple Music launched 18 months ago. Various doom and gloomers at the time were like, will this have a big impact on Spotify? Will this be Spotify's going to collapse on the back of Apple entering the market? They're having to compete with this massively well-funded company that has all of this existing customer base. But actually, Spotify's growth has only accelerated since Apple Music launched, and some of Spotify people argue that Apple put streaming, it may not have yet gone properly mainstream, but it did put streaming into newspapers and magazines who hadn't really previously talked about it.
Yeah.
But not everybody reads that article and then signs up for Apple. Other people are like, oh, now I get what Spotify is.
They go, oh, what's this? Or I think people go, you know, the people writing articles saying, is this going to be a problem for Spotify? And people go, oh, what's Spotify?
Yeah.
And then go, oh, I can sign up to that one for free. I will take a look at it.
Or any Vodafone customer would be like, oh, that's what that button is.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll try pressing that.
Yeah, so while Apple Music started with 10 million users in January and has doubled to 20 million in December, Spotify sort of... This is the one that Daniel Ek just nonchalantly tweeted about when tweeting about something else. But 30 million subscribers in March, 40 million paying subscribers in September. So that is, you know, growing at a faster rate than Apple Music. I reckon they've got 100 million users
overall, total,
including their free users.
Although that figure's a little out of date.
That was June.
Yeah.
So that would be up as well.
And I suppose the interesting thing, and this is why there are some optimists in the music industry and the recorded music industry at the moment, is both of those services are adding a million plus subscribers, paying subscribers a month. And OK, not every one of those are paying $10, 10 euros, 10 pounds, partly because of bundles, partly because there are student discounts and there are family discounts. And of course, beyond sort of the European markets and the North American markets, in some Asian markets, they would pay the economic equivalent to £10, which might be £3 when you translate it, because, you know, it depends what the going rate for services are in those other countries.
However, some of those people who are discounted now would pay full price at some way down the line, actually. And I think, there's an argument, which I think we've discussed before on the podcast, is that once you've hooked people in and got them to set up their playlists and really kind of put some effort and time into a service, then the idea of not using it anymore becomes a bit of a pain. So you kind of go, oh, I'll have to pay for it now.
And I suppose if you want to be an optimist, at the moment, Spotify and Apple Music and every streaming service you could think of are loss-making services for all sorts of reasons. One key reason being that under the deals they do with the record companies and music publishers, in theory, they're revenue share deals. So Spotify should get to keep about 30% of its income every month, and it will reach a certain number of users where that's enough money to pay for the business. But there are also minimum guarantees in the deal. So every time a track streams, whatever happens, the labels, the publishers earn a minimum sum of money. And if that is higher than the rev share would be, then Spotify have to make up the difference, as do all the other services, with the famous exception of YouTube. So that means all these services are losing money. However, they're in the scale game, and there will be a certain number of paying users that when Spotify reach that and when Apple reach that, they'll start to become viable businesses. And the rev share will outperform minimum guarantee. They'll get to keep their money. By that point, they'll have the scale. Actually, 30% of the money will be a lot of money. And month to month, they'll become profitable. And then eventually, they'll become properly profitable businesses long term. And that's what they're aiming for. The unknown is, how many users is that?
Yes.
And in terms of, from a record industry perspective, the industry's backing growth. Having said that, CDs and downloads continue to decline. So streaming is not only having to grow the industry, it's having to compensate for the continued declines elsewhere. So how many users, paying users, does Spotify and Apple need to be commercially viable? How many paying users across the board does the record industry need for the whole thing to be long-term, sustainable, commercially viable? And you could be an optimist and say, well, you know, between Apple Music and Spotify alone, they're adding a couple of million subscribers a month. If that continues for the next 5 years, we're going to reach a point where we cross a line and everything's great. Or you could say, and this comes back to what you were saying previously, but what if there's a cap? What if once across all the services, probably getting close now, if you count the other services in addition to Spotify and Apple, to nearly at 100 million paying users across all the services worldwide? and it keeps growing, keeps growing, keeps growing. What if you get to 150 million and then it turns out that's it?
Yeah.
No one else will sign up to pay. What happens then? And if you want to be a pessimist, that's what you should be pessimistic about, because these are loss-making services. They have to go into profit at some point. If they can't reach the scale they need to go into profit, what happens then? Now, it might be that what happens then is you have to have the middle market service, the $5 service, the $2 service. It might be that we have to finally work out how to sell more advertising to make free work. And obviously, YouTube are hoping that they can play a part in that. So there is still a lot of insecurity around what's going on. I suppose the other interesting thing talking about Spotify and Apple is their different approaches in trying to sign up new users and also to distinguish themselves.
Because as you say, this year has been all about growth and not about profit. I mean, it is about profit, it is about ultimate sustainability, but at the moment it's about growing the business to a point where they can become sustainable and profitable.
And the labels are making lots of money and the publishers are making lots of money as we go, but the services themselves, the money for them is off in the distance.
So the way they, I mean, Spotify obviously sells itself on, we've got this free ad-funded service, anyone can sign up to it, that's all fine. And then we make the service so indispensable to them, and the offer of other functionality,
particularly
on mobile, will make them want to pay.
Or the ads will annoy them.
Or the ads will annoy them. But either way, they will want to pay for this service. They will see that it is of value and worth paying for. Apple, of course, it has a free trial, but it doesn't have a freemium ad-funded level.
No, so it's equivalent to free as the Beats One radio station, which I'm not sure anyone listens to. Gets a lot of hype, though.
Yeah.
Gets them in the news, gets them on the social networks. But ultimately, they need something else beyond come to us for free. It's free, it's free, it's free. Ha ha, now we've got you for free. We're going to try and upsell you. That's not really what Apple have. So what's their little tactic?
Well, they have exclusives.
They do have the exclusives.
Yes. They're not the only service doing this. Obviously, Tidal is known very much for its exclusives. And over the last year or so, it's done fairly well at signing people up through its exclusives. But it's been a while since it's had a big one. Interestingly, Yasin Bey, or Mos Def, he was supposed to be releasing his final album last week. Possibly the week before now. 2 weeks ago. I don't know if this stage, because we're recording this a bit before Christmas, has actually come out, but it did not come out on its allotted release date when it was supposed to be a Tidal exclusive. But they did earlier this year, did very well with the Kanye exclusive on his album, in which we discussed that, and he kept changing the album. It was sort of a work in progress until he locked it down, and then it was available on other services. And that really helped sign up people to Tidal. Well, it still remains it still remains a small service compared to the others. But Apple's done a lot of exclusives, and I suppose Frank Ocean was one of their big ones this year that got a lot of attention.
Exclusives, of course, remain a little bit controversial.
Yes.
And there are plenty of artists and managers and labels who think that when we say exclusives, I mean, it's for a period of time, and it's usually a relatively short period of time. So you have to be very impatient, because it's normally fortnight, maybe a month.
Yeah, but Apple does have some things that aren't available elsewhere still. I mean, Frank Ocean's Blonde album did go onto other services, although the precursor to that still only, I mean, that was a video-based thing. It makes it more difficult to translate to other places, but it's still Apple only.
But even when the exclusives are just for a couple of weeks or whatever, there are plenty of people who think, well, that's anti-consumer. Because if Apple or Tidal have that big new release, whether it's for a fortnight or perhaps it's for longer than that, perhaps it's for 6 months, perhaps it's for a year, over here you've got our 40 million Spotify subscribers who are all putting £10 a month or whatever into the music industry. So they're the best customers. They are basically saving the record industry. And then certain artists are saying to those 40 million people who are saving the record industry, screw you. Apple wrote me a check, so you can't have my music for a month or whatever. And that's not good. It's good for the person who gets the check. And of course, Frank Ocean negotiated himself out of his record contract with Universal, and therefore didn't have Universal backing him on Blonde. He weirdly did on that low-key precursor, but it allowed him to do a really big global marketing campaign on what was basically a DIY release. So obviously that's very exciting for Frank Ocean. So it's good for the artists, and some other artists, I think it's more about the money than it is the marketing power. But for the music industry and the music community at large, there are plenty of people that say, stop doing these exclusives. It's not the right way to do it. And in the main, although in the past Spotify has sometimes done deals more with heritage artists who were late to the party and had a little bit of exclusive time. That's not something Spotify has been trying to go into. It's expensive. I mean, I think Apple have a big pockets. Tidal are just incredibly well connected because they're basically artists who work with Jay-Z in some of where, and of course some artists have a stake in Tidal. Spotify in the main haven't got into the exclusives, and beyond the whole freemium sells premium model that they've done ever since day one, with Spotify, they're trying to distinguish themselves from the Tidals and the Apples more with, well, A, their discovery services, so Discover Weekly, but there are other discovery services that have sort of gone on and ever more sophisticated playlisting, but also they're sort of moving more into becoming like a radio station. And actually what their exclusive content isn't exclusive albums, it's, well, we're creating radio style programs, documentaries, accessions, etc. And because that's our content, you can only get that on Spotify.
Yeah, and ultimately, I mean, that seems like a more long-term pull. I don't think, like, your exclusives can't be the thing that is the norm forever, I think. I mean, not in the way they are now.
No,
and I think, I mean, Apple have recently acknowledged that, or they've said they're going to continue with that program for the moment. But I think in terms of Spotify building up just good technology, like Discover Weekly has been very popular. A lot of people like it. I find that it just recommends me really, really boring. And it's slightly insulted by the music it recommends me.
But you went through a period of being very down on it, then quite up on it.
Yeah, I know, but it's got really boring, and it's like, it's going, here, oh, we've seen what you like listening to, and we think this will be stuff that you'll like. No, I don't like any of this.
But perhaps you just have very weird tastes in music.
The Daily Mix service that it launched more recently, where it gives you 6 mixes based on different styles of music that it thinks you like, those are much, much better and something that I use quite a lot.
Different services thing for different people,
the,
isn't it?
This year's 2016 review that they've done, they basically put together various playlists of 2016, but they do, like, here's the tracks you listened to most this year. Then you go, all right, these are all good tracks, except one of my playlists. I'm like, I'm pretty sure I didn't listen to this a lot, and it is shit. But apparently, maybe I did listen to it several times.
But Spotify sort of shifted into becoming more like a radio station, and obviously behind the scenes there have been a lot of hires nabbing, particularly BBC people.
Yeah, BBC people who've gone, oh, what things could we do? Oh, we could do something, basically just do the Live Lounge.
Yes, just let's copy what we used to do at Radio 1 on Spotify. So, I agree with you. I think that actually has more long-term potential, and that's a way for Spotify to, A, differentiate itself from Apple. It'll be interesting to see whether down the line they start putting some of that content, in essence, behind the paywall. So perhaps they're high-profile documentaries you'll only be able to get as a premium user, and that will be another way to try and upsell the free users to the premium. So it'll be interesting to see how they develop all of those features in 2017. We said that the only services really worth talking about are Spotify and Apple Music. Having said that, we should quickly name-check in the US what's going on with Pandora and iHeart,
yes,
which we'll definitely want to watch in 2017. So they have been traditionally personalised radio services rather than fully on demand. So they play a stream of music that they think, well, a bit like Discover Weekly, that they think you'll like based on a couple of bits of information that you provide, but they're not a fully on demand experience. Except now they are. Both iHeart and Pandora are moving into a fully on demand experience. It's also efforts, both of those companies really have made most of their money to date by selling advertising. iHeart has only ever been a free service until now, although Pandora did have premium, nobody bothered. So they were basically making their money out of ad sales, although not making enough money. So they're now moving into fully on demand, charging $10 a month. Also, $5 a month option for sort of premium personalized listening. iHeart's interesting because they're also the biggest AM/FM radio broadcaster in the US, and they're going to pull their radio programming in, so a little bit like Spotify there, except that they've got this massive body of radio shows that they can sort of tap into. And although those are only US services really to date, you can get them in Australia and New Zealand, but predominantly they're US services. Pandora in particular has global ambitions, and by moving into on-demand for tedious licensing reasons we won't get into, is now in a position to expand globally in a way that they weren't previously. So both iHeart and Pandora, which are phenomenal services in the US in terms of users. I mean, between them, iHeart and Pandora have more users in the US than Spotify and Apple do worldwide. So they're already massive services in the US, but it will be interesting to see whether or not they can persuade those users to sign up for the paid-for version, and also what happens as they potentially move globally. And then, of course, the other service that has done some interesting things this year, to date on a relatively small level, but could become a lot bigger in 2017.
Yeah, it remains definitely the one to watch.
Is good old Amazon.
Yes.
So obviously they've had music as part of Amazon Prime for a while now, but they've now launched a standalone service in a few territories, which is basically a Spotify carbon copy ripoff if you take the straight £10 a month package, but they also have a cheaper package for Amazon Prime subscribers and, crucially, that £4 a month option if you're willing to only listen to it through your Amazon Echo speaker system. Which is reliant on this idea that there is a market out there who only really want the streaming experience when they're at home. They don't need it in the car. They don't need it on the move. They want it super high quality through a speaker system at home. But therefore, they're not willing to pay £120 a year because they only want to use it a couple of times a week in their house. But at £4 a month, integrated with a decent speaker system, perhaps that's a service. So the question is, I think that market is out there. But is it 9 people? Or is it 9 million people?
Yeah.
And that will almost will be behind whether or not Amazon is a success in this market, because really that's the USP. That's what will make Amazon potentially a different service for a different demographic than what Spotify and Apple Music are already doing.
Yes. And we discussed last week at length the problems facing SoundCloud as it goes into 2017, having had Spotify pull out of talks to buy it, which leaves it without a buyer.
In a tricky position. Done its licensing deal, so now has, you know, not the copyright problems that it previously had.
Yeah, so obviously, yeah, it launched its own on-demand service this year, which we don't think has been massively successful.
Yeah, so it has its £10 a month service. It also rolled out the advertising platform that previously was only available in the US, is now happening in other countries too. So SoundCloud is trying to make a go of it as a more sort of conventional streaming platform in addition to everything it's always done.
But ultimately it's looking for a buyer.
Really, it needs a buyer to be able to compete with the likes of Spotify and Apple Music. It's not really clear who's going to do it. So we said a year ago that 2016 was a make or break year for SoundCloud. Well, okay, it certainly didn't make it. It didn't break it, but I 2017 is going to be an interesting year for SoundCloud. We like SoundCloud. We hope they can find a way to make it work. But without a buyer, it's going to be a tricky year. Talking of streaming services that have had a tricky year.
Yeah, well, you discussed making a go of the ad-funded business and turning that into a success. Guevara had a go at that.
They did.
So, and it was not a success.
So Guevara have been around for a long time. They're originally an ad-funded download platform, then shifted into streaming based out of Australia. Active in Australia and various Asian markets, tried to launch in the UK by buying Blinkbox a couple of years back. That was a disaster.
Yeah, shut it down.
And they have always been adamant that certainly in the Asian markets, free streaming, ad-funded streaming, that's the future. You know, we're not competing with Spotify and Apple Music because we're going for the markets where paid for will never work. It's all about ad-funded. It's all about free.
Well, they were basically saying, yeah, the industry gave up on ad-funded too quickly and there is money out there. And if someone goes for it, they can make a big success of it. And they tried to IPO.
They did, with that line.
Yes, and then the IPO was blocked by the stock exchange they were trying to float on.
Yes, although, I mean, they may be right that there is advertising money out there that music industry's given up on too quickly. I would say big bad YouTube is most likely to work out a way of getting that money if just the music industry could work out a way of, or indeed YouTube could work out a way of making up with there. But yeah, Guevara might be onto something, but they're not the business to deliver it. And the IPO, they put out that prospectus, and it was just basically a beginner's guide to why you shouldn't try and set up a streaming service in terms of the financials, to the extent that the Australian stock exchange they wanted to float on wouldn't let them.
Yeah, then they end up putting two of their businesses into administration, withdrawing from certain markets, including Australia, where they're based.
Yeah.
And the last news on that was that they'd had to cancel their AGM because they couldn't afford to pay the auditors whose figures they were hoping to present.
So it has not been a good year for Guevara. They are still trading in a few markets, a few Asian markets. Those two subsidiaries they put into administration did ultimately come out of administration.
Yeah, they did.
Still in a very tricky position. As Andy mentioned, we are recording this podcast a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. There's still a few days to go before this podcast actually goes live. So who knows what will happen in the last couple of weeks of 2016 for Guevara. But I don't think you have to be too much of a pessimist to say that 2017 could be the year that Guevara drops off the list.
Yeah.
In my digital market masterclass, I have a slide with all the logos of the services that aren't Spotify and Apple and SoundCloud and YouTube. And every so often I have to update it, normally taking logos off rather than adding them. So we'll see whether or not Guevara stays on that PowerPoint slide for the whole of 2017. But it would not surprise me if it wasn't one that I had to press the old delete key on.
Well, we'll wait and see. Yet to come, the lovely world of safe harbours, and also some of our more light, amusing stories that we've enjoyed this year. But now, secondary ticketing, which we have talked about a lot
to the extent
lately.
That even though in recent weeks there have been some big developments, Andy got bored talking about it. But I think it would be wrong to discuss the music business year of 2016.
I don't think you could deny that secondary ticketing was definitely one of the big stories of 2016.
It was one of the big talking points. Now, of course, secondary ticketing, the resale of tickets via online platforms like StubHub or SeatWave. Or
via GoGo.
Via GoGo. Online ticket touting, as we like to call it. Scalping, if you will insist on being American. but we're going to call it touting from this point onwards, even though we have some American listeners. Online ticket touting. It's been a talking point now. Where are we? 2016. For well over 10 years. I would say around about 2004, when eBay was first starting to really gain mainstream momentum.
Yeah.
And people started selling tickets on eBay. That's when the secondary ticketing conversation first became a debate within the music industry. And obviously, touting wasn't new. We all remember the old touts buying and selling tickets outside venues. And it was sort of like, people were never that happy with touting. But when it was one guy, two guys, providing they weren't like, you know, getting in the way or fighting with each other, as did sometimes happen. In the main, people turned a blind eye to touting. But online touting, it was sort of like, you know, tape-to-tape piracy going to file sharing. It sort of took everything to a much bigger level. And relatively early on, before these standalone sites like StubHub had really gained much momentum, certainly here in the UK, there was a big debate. And I can remember, this is when the Labour government was still in power here in the UK,
yeah,
probably about 10 years ago, maybe slightly less than that. There was a whole few years where consumer rights groups first put it on the agenda because they felt that consumers were being ripped off because increasing numbers of tickets were going on the secondary sites and were being sold at a huge markup. And consumer rights groups said to government, you should do something about this. And so government went to the music industry and the live industry and the promoters and the managers and said, you should do something about this. And the promoters and the managers said, oh, it's good that you've brought this up because actually we'd like you, government, to do something about this. Can't you regulate? Can't you stop this? And government were like, no, we shouldn't regulate. You should do something in the industry. And it went backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. And there was lots of conferences and panel debates and various people had various solutions and then nothing happened. And sort of everyone stopped talking about it. Even though behind the scenes, StubHub, ViGoGo were really gaining momentum. The number of tickets being sold was going up and up and up. But people sort of stopped talking about it. In the US, it became a talking point. Generally in the US, until very recently, it was felt that any regulation on secondary ticketing, or indeed ticket touting or ticket reselling, would come at a state level rather than a federal level. So generally, this debate in the US has happened in New Jersey or New York State rather than a US-wide level, although that is actually now starting to change. Meanwhile, back here in the UK, the live community was sort of split. And you had half of the promoters and managers saying, why have we stopped talking about this? Why didn't the government do anything? We should regulate, we should outlaw, we should ban, we should be trying to stop this. And the other half were more pragmatic and said, clearly nothing's going to happen. So do you know what? If you can't beat them, join them.
Yes.
And better off, if tickets are going to go on the market and if there's going to be an upsell, better off we benefit in that and let's make it part of our business. And so you started to have promoters and managers and artists and agents putting their own tickets onto secondary sites, usually anonymously, which is where it gets a little bit dodgy, but sometimes they would actively sell themselves on those sites. Other times they would do deals with touts and say, okay, well, here's some tickets, mark them up and then we get half of the markup or whatever. And that business started to grow. And then I suppose here in the UK, there was then that Dispatches documentary a few years
yeah.
ago, which really looked at that side of the business,
yeah.
the fact that the industry was complicit and some of the secondary sites were complicit. Because, of course, throughout all of this, the secondary sites have always said, we're just a website where people who bought tickets for a gig, genuinely wanting to go, and then just suddenly for some reason they got the, you know, they got a cold or there was some family commitment they had to go to, they need to raise sales. That's what our platform's for. It's not for industrial-level touts who have built multi-million dollar businesses reselling tickets
yeah.
for profit. It's about individuals. And that has always been the line. And, of course, the Dispatches document, I mean, we all knew that. That was a nonsense anyway. But the Dispatches document sort of blew all of that out. And so there was another debate for about 6 months on the back of that. Then it all went quiet again. And then France did bring in some quite rigorous regulation that basically says you can still do the sort of individual selling a few tickets here and there, but industrial level touting in theory in France is outlawed, although then you have the question of, is anyone enforcing? There's one thing, passing a law.
Yeah.
Does anyone enforce it? And it all ticked along. And then the latest period all came about because a couple of years ago, Sharon Hodgson, an MP, Labour MP, who's been very vocal about this for a long time now, Mike Weatherly, who was a Tory MP, no longer, he stood down at the last election, but he was there in Parliament a couple of years ago. The Consumer Rights Act was going through Parliament, and they decided this is the perfect opportunity to try and get some secondary ticketing regulation into law.
Yes. And so, yeah, they snuck a little bit of that in to, regulate the secondary ticketing market, which ultimately mostly got through. And there were some new rules laid down and those went ahead and everyone clapped and said, oh, that's a good thing, isn't it? But then this year, there's been a lot of focus on the fact that actually it's not really worked as people had hoped, because it's not entirely clear who is responsible for policing these things. So there are things like you have to publish the seat number and the original price of the ticket and also any restrictions, including the fact that it could be cancelled if you buy it from a secondary ticketing site.
Because most tickets have terms and conditions.
And resale is one of the things that is generally prohibited on these tickets.
But in common with what we said about the French regulation, although these new rules were put in there, the one thing which they didn't get through in the Consumer Rights Act was they wanted to force people to reveal their identity.
Yeah.
So that then promoters could basically see who was reselling tickets, go and find the bookings and cancel the tickets, because they're allowed to do that under the terms and conditions. That didn't go through. However, there was some regulation there, and as you say, that was great. But the question is, who enforces this? And the ambiguity you alluded to is, whose obligation is it to ensure this happens? Is it the seller's obligation, in which case there's lots of those people and we don't really know who they are and where they live? Or is it actually the obligation of StubHub, Seatwave, Get Me In and Viagogo? And it's their job to ensure that all that information is provided. The law is a little bit ambiguous. Nobody in terms of, you know, the state is particularly enforcing those rules. However, the one thing that the Consumer Rights Act also did, which really kept the momentum going and led to all the stuff that's happened since the summer here in the UK, is, as well as introducing these regulations, the Act said 6 months after these regulations were introduced, we'll do a big government review of secondary ticketing and we'll get an independent person to review the market and we'll get a report published and then we'll decide if we should do anything else. And that was the Waterson review.
Yep.
And so that meant that, having had a load of conversation around secondary ticketing because of the Consumer Rights Act, we then had a whole load of conversation about secondary ticketing while Waterson was doing his review. We then had a whole load more when the Waterson review was actually published. And so basically, for about 18 months, there had been constant talking. And there were various recommendations in the Waterson review. Because of bloody Brexit, the whole review's sort of been on hold ever since. And we're told the government will tell us in the new year what they're going to do with it. But all of that meant that momentum in the music community, who, as I say, had been very vocal and active on this 10 years ago, then sort of all went a bit quiet on it. Because the artist community were being called on to support the legislation and then to input to the review and then to respond to the review, you've got managers and artists in particular, and really this is artist management driven, although there are some promoters and agents involved as well, all reached a point earlier this year where it's like, no, we need to have a much more organised campaign on this, A, to lobby to ensure that those regulations in the Consumer Rights Act are enforced. And we think that the platform should enforce it. And so therefore, we need to get clarity on that. But even if that isn't the way, Waterson was saying that Trading Standards should take responsibility for enforcing this. So we need to make sure that happens. That needs budget. So we need to lobby for budget. And there are other things which, A, artists and managers and promoters themselves could be doing with the way they sell their tickets on the primary platforms to combat touting. And there's some other regulations that we think probably should be added or clarified down the line within the law. And so all of this resulted in the Fanfare Alliance, which, it has to be said, since it launched earlier this year, has certainly captured the news agenda.
Yeah.
And won quite a little bit of support in Parliament, that's slowly seemingly persuading government that actually, well, certainly their response to Waterson needs to be a bloody good, firm response.
Yeah, and actually, while the campaign initially, it was very much focused on the fact that this new legislation was put into the Consumer Rights Act, but hasn't really been enforced and it needs to be enforced, what actually tipped the balance at the end was the use of bots, which is basically software that touts use to automatically buy up hundreds of tickets as soon as they go on sale.
Off the primary sites.
Never giving actual real music fans a chance to buy them themselves.
And that software is the reason why every 2 months we get that press release, record sellout of this concert, because 90% of the tickets have all been bought up by software that gets ever more efficient buying those tickets up.
And then those tickets, immediately turn up on the secondary sites at inflated, massively inflated prices in many instances. That sort of became the thing that got through, partly because it's a very easy thing to be anti, and also it's the one thing that the secondary sites themselves say, we shouldn't be allowing that, that's terrible.
Yes, and I mean, so the bots thing has been on the agenda as part of this debate for some time, although it wasn't part of the Consumer Rights Act, partly because there is an argument that under the Computer Misuse Act, is that what it's called? Something like that. Technically, there's an argument that it may already be illegal to use those bots, that software, although that's sort of to be clarified by Parliament or tested in court. So it wasn't part of those specific regulations. But yeah, you're right that this is interestingly, generally speaking, the secondary sites throughout have had the same line, which is we shouldn't regulate, you should be allowed to resell tickets, free market, blah, blah, blah. There's also the argument of if you overregulate us, then people will stop selling with us. They'll all start using sites in Russia or somewhere else in the world where you can't regulate. And what we do as UK-based businesses is we have the consumer guarantee. So if you buy a ticket and then the ticket doesn't get you into the event, either because it was a fake ticket, straight fraud, or because the ticket is cancelled, then we'll refund the money. And that random classified site in Russia ain't going to provide that protection. So surely better to keep it on our platforms. Is the argument that they usually use. But they will then sort of throw in, and a cynic, do you know any cynics?
No.
A cynic would say it's a distraction technique, but the thing they would say is, if you're going to regulate about anything, regulate about the bots.
Yeah.
But I think what the Fanfare Alliance recognised was, that's not a solution, because we know that touts get tickets from other sources. For starters, they're getting them from promoters and agents and managers direct. So it's not a panacea by any stretch. Having said that, if it's the one thing that the platforms claim they're pro, then we might as well get that on the statute. We might as well get that law. If it's the one thing which supposedly is uncontroversial, let's get that sorted, get the other regulations enforced, and then decide what to do next.
Yeah. And so when this all went before a common select committee, and essentially they were there to talk about the bots issue. But what happened was that the representatives of the secondary sites went up before the select committee and their answers were slightly evasive. And then ultimately the politicians said, this has raised a lot of other issues. We think bots are bad and we should do something about them. But also, these guys were evasive and didn't really answer our questions properly. We need to look at this even further.
So that was the Culture, Sport and Media Select Committee in Parliament. But it included some MPs who in the past, because they were sort of on the sort of the free market conservative side of the political agenda, were like, no, we shouldn't be meddling with this, who are now saying, there's lots of stuff wrong here.
And partly that is, I mean, aside from, the secondary sites perhaps not representing themselves as they would like or the MPs would like them to, it was the organisation of the Fanfare Alliance, whereas this campaign hasn't had the organisation perhaps it needed on the industry side before. And so having kind of representative artist managers and artists themselves up in Parliament saying this is why this is bad for our business really kind of got that argument across to the MPs, who, as you say, in the past, a number of them had said there's no need for legislation here.
And I suppose in terms of what that argument is, I mean, obviously, there's a straight consumer rights argument. And it's interesting, this is of all the things that the music industry has lobbied for, it's the one that the fans truly get behind. I mean, when it comes to things like piracy, it's bad for artists, it's bad for songwriters, that's the argument. But it's quite hard to get the fans rallying in your support because basically it's fans saying, I don't want that free music that I've been getting. Whereas with this, it's the fans who are paying these over the odds prices. So therefore, when artists go out and say, we don't like touting, hey fans, support us on this, sign this petition, all the fans go and sign the petition. So there's a consumer rights side.
As we said before, I mean, with the piracy argument, you can say, if you ban this over here, people will go to unregulated places over there. And while that probably is true to an extent of the secondary market, there's less of a, fans don't want to go and pay over the odds for their tickets. You know, it's not like they're going to be going, I can't believe StubHub's been shut down. I really want to spend £1,000 more than I need to on a ticket. Where am I? I'll go to Russia.
And also there's the issue that it's handing over credit card information. And I suppose when you've got StubHub, which has an eBay logo on it, because it's owned by eBay, and you have SeatWave and you have Get Me In, which have a Ticketmaster logo, because
well,
they're owned
by Ticketmaster. Well, and also actively promoted on the primary Ticketmaster website.
And indeed, whenever you go anywhere on the tube in London, you see advertising for all of these sites. They seem like legitimate concerns. So yeah, I'll give you my credit card information reluctantly, because I don't want to pay over the odds. Whereas some dodgy looking sites somewhere else in the world that you've never heard of, you're less likely to go there. But beyond the consumer rights argument, I suppose from the artist side, there's the element of, well, some people would say, and indeed there was a bit of research came out earlier this year from the US, I think, that said this, is, well, you know, if you put your tickets on the market at £40 and then they go up to £300 on eBay and some tout's making the markup, well, clearly you underpriced your gigs. And artists would say one of two things, which is A, on a mere ethical level, you know, there are plenty of bigger name artists out there who know that they could charge £300 for their tickets, but they also know that their core fan base can't afford £300 for their tickets. And they want to play to a room full of fans rather than a room full of people who can afford to pay £300 for a ticket. So there's an sort of ethical level. There's also the business level, which is artists want to play to full rooms. So therefore, you price in a way that means that you're going to get a full room. And also, some people say, well, artists aren't playing enough gigs. If they played more gigs, it wouldn't be a problem. And it's like, well, sort of, yes, but you're trying to create a bit of demand. And of course, the other issue is the music industry is increasingly about fan data. It's about knowing who your fans are and where they live. And if you're selling tickets to some random tout who's then reselling the ticket, you're losing that fan relationship. You don't know who your fans are or where they live. So there's the consumer rights argument. And also, it screws with the artist model in both an ethical way and a business way. So these are the arguments put forward by the Fanfare Alliance. And as you say, Ticketmaster and StubHub came in, didn't come out very well from that select committee. And I suppose where we're at now on the bot ban front, Nigel Adams MP, who chairs the APPG for Music in Parliament, had already suggested that the digital economy bill that's currently working its way through Parliament could include a bot ban. Government then said, oh, we think it's probably covered by the Computer Misuse Act, so don't worry about it just yet. But then on the back of that select committee, there was such a movement of, oh, for God's sake, we just need a line in law that very clearly states bots ban. So that's now back on the agenda. Government are indicating that they will probably back it when the Digital Economy Bill in its final amended form goes before the Commons. We're now waiting for the response from the government to the Waterston Review, but I think it will be a much firmer, more proactive response than it would have been a year ago. And then the other thing happening on the aside, also at the recommendation of the Select Committee, is that the tax man, the HMRC, is going and finding out, because some of the industrial level touts will have multiple identities on the services, so you don't know who you're buying off. There's also the thing that actually, if they're industrial level, even though ticket touting regulations don't force you to reveal the identity of the seller, once you reach a certain level of commerce, business law says that you should. So there's various things about the way these industrial level touts operate, and the tax man is going in to investigate because they think that they're not declaring all that income and it's not getting taxed properly either. Plus, the Competition and Markets Authority, as it happens, sort of by coincidence, is investigating the Big Four anyway. So there's all this stuff going. So I think this story is going to run and run into 2017, and it will be interesting to see what regulations get added and whether or not those regulations are enforced, and even if they are enforced, whether it works, because it's not a foregone conclusion that they will. There's also some other people on the peripheries with sort of new technologies and new approaches. We're going to probably have a CMU Trends article about some of those ideas in the new year. So there's a lot of debate ongoing, but it does feel that a debate that's sort of been on and off and on and off and on and off for 12 years now is very much on at the moment. And of course, not only in the UK.
Yes, in a wider sense, recently, Italy is moving very quickly towards a ban.
An outright ban on
reselling tickets entirely unless you are the promoter.
Or endorsed by the promoter.
So
I suppose, in some ways, similar to the French regulation, except that the penalties are very severe.
Yeah.
Question is, will they enforce it? So we'll see. Also, obviously, Italy have their referendum on their constitution and it's all a bit political chaos at the moment, so it may or may not actually get added to law in the new year, although certainly it had gone through the parliament in Italy and was set to become law.
And then in the US, at a federal level, they've just banned the use of bots.
As I alluded to, yes. So this is in Washington, and so yes, the use of bots will be illegal on a federal level.
Yeah, so across the country rather than the state level, which is where legislation of this type is normally done. So it's kind of like the bot's already banned in New York.
Yes, and that ban was ramped up. So there was actual potential jail sentence recently. But yes, this will be a US-led development. And other country, Japan as well, ticket touting's been on
there's
the agenda.
Whole, yeah, there's a kind of fanfare-style campaign over there. Resale No, it's called. Obviously not in...
in
it's called something else in Japanese, but I can't remember what that was.
So yeah, this is all gaining momentum. And I suppose the last thing to say about all of this is Live Nation's role in all of this. Because it's interesting, isn't it, that we've got very much the management community, some of the independent promoters and agents are coming on board. But Live Nation owns Ticketmaster, which in turn owns lots of secondary sites around the world. So obviously, as we've already said, here in the UK, Seatwave, Get Me In. Tickets Now is the big one in the US. So Live Nation is very much in the secondary ticketing game, also the biggest promoter in the world, second biggest venue owner, biggest management company in the world. And so Live Nation's role in all of this is very interesting. Live Nation is sort of standing firm and sort of saying, you know, it's better it to be part of a legitimate business than it is for it to be sort of black market. And you know, it's you know, two services, fans who are willing to be there on the Friday morning, do the refresh thing, get it one price, fans who want to show up last minute, pay another price. It's all legitimate, blah, blah, blah. But it will be interesting, certainly here in the UK, some really high-profile artists are now very much backing this campaign. If we see something similar, I mean, Bruce Springsteen has ranted about this in the past, but if we see big-name artists in the US coming on the back of this, it's now a good part of Live Nation's business. They continue to say it's legitimate, it should be, but will they come under increased pressure as, A, new rules and regs are introduced around the world, and B, if the artists who have been uniting in individual countries started to unite globally, well, that would be an interesting situation to see. So we probably will still be talking about touting in a year's time, but hopefully with some really tangible developments and testing whether or not these new regulations work.
Before we head into our final section, let's take a look at some of the stories that have amused us in 2016.
You selected five. Is it a top five? Is there
no,
any order here?
No, it's just a collection of five.
We're in a random order. Almost alphabetical order, but not quite.
No, not quite. I think they're actually in reverse chronological order.
Are they? So
Which will show you how I searched them.
How you selected this five. Well, we had a judging process.
Yeah,
there
was a real...
We reread every CMU Daily. You didn't just quickly go back through the... And finally, archive.
How dare you suggest such a thing?
In chronological order. So, Bob Dylan's Nobel Prize amused you, Andy Malt.
I have enjoyed this story so much, and I'm quite glad that there could be as much as 6 months' worth of it to come, depending on what happens with his lecture.
So, the Nobel Prize people presumably realised when they gave their prize for literature to Bob Dylan, a singer-songwriter, that might be a little bit controversial. That was probably partly behind the decision, but they probably didn't realise just how amusing it would be.
Yeah, because Bob didn't... normally, if you announce something like, oh, you've won the Nobel Prize, immediately the winner will go, blimey, that's good, isn't it? But Bob Dylan said nothing at all for like a week and a half.
And
just leaving a void in which for people to speculate about why that might be. And especially as it wasn't that he was kind of out of the public eye. He was performing live.
And he had a book out, didn't he?
In a book out. He was in active mode. And so, yeah, and did not mention it at all. It briefly, a mention of it briefly appeared on his website and then was almost immediately removed.
And it clearly been put there by a PR rather than by Bob Dylan himself.
I don't think Bob Dylan updates his own website, but... who knows?
And so the organisers, initially they were quite blasé about it.
They got a bit annoyed.
but it was sort of like, well, there were two events that come off the back of winning a Nobel Prize. First of all, there's the event where you're actually presented with the award. And then usually in the week running up to that, but it doesn't have to be, you're meant to deliver your winning lecture, a lecture as a winner.
And that's the thing that gets you your prize money, which is a lot of money.
Nearly a million.
Yeah, nearly $1 million. I mean, it's different because it's
around
Swedish krona, isn't it? But it comes out about $800,000-$900,000, depending on the exchange rate.
And so then it became, it's a bit odd he's not responding. And then it's like, whoa, is he not going to show up to pick up the award?
Is he angry?
Is he not going to do this lecture, even though it's worth $800,000? And so, as you say, in the absence... I mean, actually, it was only a week and a half. I mean...
yeah, but in this day and
in
age...
In the internet age...
A week and a half is a long time.
Where's my tweet? you know, Donald Trump would have tweeted at 3 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah.
Where's Bob Dylan's tweet?
Yeah.
And so approximately 4,009 journalists speculated what we should interpret from Dylan's apparent shunning of the Nobel Prize. But it wasn't a shunning.
No, because he then he gave an interview to The Telegraph, I think it was, where he was just like, yeah, of course, I'm happy to win the prize. It's great. I love it. And then he wrote a letter to the Swedish Academy, who organised the Nobel Prize in Literature, and said, I'm so honoured to receive this. This is brilliant. And we all thought, oh, that's the end of that story.
Everything is on.
Everything's on.
Although we still had the question, will he show up to the prize event?
Yes.
And which happens in Sweden.
The Swedish Academy said they'd been talking to him and he said he would show up. However, he wouldn't do a press conference.
No journalist interviews.
But he would definitely show up.
Even though he'd announced he was accepting this prize through a journalist.
Yeah.
No more journalists. No.
I've done my bit.
Not talking to media.
And then, but they was like, all right, so that's all fine. It's all set now. And then after that, suddenly he went, oh no, he's not coming. He's got something else on.
He suddenly realised he was in Sweden.
Yeah. It's like, wait, oh, this isn't down the road from my house. So he did that. He shunned that. He also, Barack Obama held a thing at the White House for this year's Nobel Prize winners. Who, you know, they all turned up except Bob, who couldn't be asked.
But he did send a message,
yeah,
and an ambassador.
Yes.
To the prize giving.
Yes. So, yeah, he sent a speech which was read out by the US ambassador to Sweden. And Patti Smith went and sang one of his songs in his place. She fluffed the words.
But a great performance.
Still a
that.
Great performance. Perhaps all the better for the fluffing. And she wrote a thing about that afterward, which is worth reading. But we've still got the matter of this lecture, which, as you say, it's supposed to happen.
Where's my lecture?
The event happens on the 10th of December, the prize-giving event, which is the anniversary of Alfred Nobel's death, I think. And the lecture generally happens on the 7th of December, but the rules are you have to give it within 6 months of
the
10th of
December. They recognise that some people are busy.
Yes.
And so providing you do it in 6 months, you still get your 800 grand. And they're willing to be flexible.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a speech. Basically, I think the Nobel Prize pot...
they said you basically...
I think the judges were hoping for a free Bob Dylan gig.
Yeah.
Well, 800 grand, it's not that free,
yeah,
is it? But they sort of alluded that it could be a gig rather than a traditional lecture, whatever Bob wanted to do. But we're yet to get that in the diary.
Yes. So who knows? They said he's got a gig in Sweden in springtime. So maybe he'll do it then. But I don't think he has given any indication as to whether he's going to actually do it or not.
So as you say, even though the Nobel Prizes have been presented for this year, there potentially is still some additional comedy gold to come from the awarding of the Literature Prize to Bob Dylan, which was the first of the five stories that amused Andy Malt this year.
Yeah. And now, you might not think that Ed Sheeran being stabbed in the face was a funny story, but I can assure you that it was.
I would say this was my favourite story of the year, possibly.
Of all time.
I don't know of all time, but for a long time. But he was fine.
He's made light of it since, so it's absolutely fine.
If he'd actually been actually permanently damaged because the sword that struck his face got very close to his eye, so this could have been a horrible, horrible story.
Yeah, this definitely could have not been a funny story.
But the good news is it wasn't, and that's good news for two reasons. A, it's good news because Ed Sheeran isn't permanently injured by this, but it's also good news because it means that we can laugh at this story in a way that we would not have done.
Because, I mean, so we've discussed this before.
Yeah, remind us what happened.
But what happened was...
the sequence of events.
Ed Sheeran went to a party round Princess Beatrice's gaff. Prince Andrew's gaff, in fact. But, you know, where she lives too. And James Blunt was there too. And James Blunt, being James Blunt, at some point said, oh, I quite fancy being a knight. And Princess Beatrice went, oh, I could sort that out for you, and ran off and got a sword, and came back and knighted James Blunt, and then swung the sword back over her shoulder into Ed Sheeran's face.
And despite us insisting this is a funny story, he did have to go to hospital.
Yeah, he had to have stitches.
So it really did cut into his face.
He went back to the party afterwards.
He did, so he can't have been that damaging. But nevertheless, a little bit of drama. That's what happens when Ed, James and Beatrice all get together.
So perhaps we should keep them apart.
for a palace party. Well, James Blunt back next year with a new album. He threatened on Twitter this week. And by the time this podcast goes out, the Ed Sheeran album could be out.
Yeah.
Who knows? He's been hinting as we get ready to record this podcast. So even though Ed Sheeran's face is intact, there could be an Ed Sheeran James Blunt album off in early 2017. So perhaps
you could throw it at each other's faces.
Perhaps we could have a little bit more of sword-based interaction between those two in 2017.
Talking of interaction, Justin Bieber was interacting with his fans this year.
Or attempting to.
Attempting to. He did a lot of interacting, which involved him telling them to shut up.
So this was specifically his British fans.
Yeah.
So Bieber was in the UK touring, and it seemed that possibly taking inspiration from Kanye, who knows, that he's decided that he wants to have a point in his gig where he stops singing his songs and he has a little chat with his audience, like an old singer-songwriter telling a little anecdote, a little story. But it's quite hard to chat to your audience when there are, I don't know, 4,000 of them and they are all screaming at the top of their voices, which A, makes it very hard for you to be heard above that noise, and B, one assumes if someone's screaming at the top of their voice, however loud your speaker system may be, they're not going to hear what you're saying.
They're not listening. They're not giving you the respect that you, Justin Bieber, deserve.
So Bieber started off by just being, "Will you shut up. But he got more and more firm as the tour went on.
And walked off stage one of the gigs. Eventually came back and explained why he'd done that. But yeah, he dropped the mic and stormed off. And it was very unhappy with his fans. And I didn't know. There were gigs where it was all right.
Well, if I remember rightly, the one gig where he actually got his audience to shut up, he then spent the sort of little storytelling moment, or someone said, "Why are you so beautiful?" And then he was talking about his parents being beautiful, so that when they had sex, of course, he was going to be beautiful. And it was all
preferred the screaming.
Let's go back to the screaming. This is all a little bit tedious. But so some audiences were all right. But hey, British Bieber fans, shut up.
Be quiet. It's obviously been a year of many political upheavals the world over. But in the UK, we've had a couple of things. There was Jeremy Corbyn's new leadership battle.
Yes.
Which is the thing that happened in the summer. Took up. I don't know if people outside the UK would have noticed this.
Yes.
But it was big news. Because Jeremy Corbyn,
leader of the Labour Party, had to run. Well, he to be leader of the Labour Party.
Became leader of the Labour Party in something of an upset. And a lot of the Labour Party were not happy about this, and it has led to a massive division in the Labour Party. It's not been the best thing for them, you could perhaps say. And so there was a challenge.
The challenge followed the EU referendum, the Brexit referendum, because it was felt that in theory the Labour Party was meant to be campaigning. I mean, obviously, the EU referendum wasn't actually a left-right thing. But officially, although there were Labour MPs campaigning for Leave, they were very much in the minority, and the Labour majority were meant to be out campaigning for Remain. But it was sort of felt that Corbyn hadn't really done a great deal for the EU referendum, and certainly a lot of Labour voters up north were voting Leave, and so it was felt that Corbyn did a bad job there. And so all the sort of Labour establishment people who never liked the fact that Corbyn won in the first place used this as an opportunity to say, right, let's get him out, let's have another leadership election. So they had another leadership election, and he won by an even higher margin.
Yes.
And remains a affable leader of a party that basically is achieving nothing at the moment.
But during his campaign,
there is a pop element to
this. Yes. During his campaign, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is a man who has often been accused of being out of date and stuck in the 80s. And
politically.
Yes.
Wrongly, I would say, but yes, because he is very much to the left of the Labour Party, the last time the Labour Party in the UK was very much a very socialist party was the 80s, so it's sort of saying, oh yeah, you're old school, you're in the past, you're not, your ideas won't work in 2016 is what his critics, certainly in the Conservatives, but also in the Labour Party, would say.
Yeah, and in a bid to overcome those accusations during his campaign, he held a press conference with UB40.
For reasons still don't understand.
No one is clear why that happened. I'm not even sure Jeremy Corbyn is clear why that happened. He certainly didn't really seem clear who they were.
The members of UB40 were very keen for everybody to know.
The members of one of the UB40s.
Well, exactly. The members of UB40 were very keen for everyone to know.
The UB40 who have the legal rights to the name UB40.
Regular CMU Daily readers, I mean, you'd probably have to be a very avid reader of CMU Daily, might remember that there are now two UB40s.
Yes.
There is UB40... And then there is UB40 with all the people you've heard of in UB40, but they're not actually called UB40.
Yes, and they put out a statement after saying that they did not endorse Jeremy Corbyn. So Jeremy Corbyn couldn't unite the Labour Party, and nor could he unite UB40. So it's not going very well.
Do you remember there was that brief period of a couple of months where it looked like there might be two hop form festivals?
Yeah.
And one of them was going to be headlined by UB40. And it was just when the two UB40s, because the members had split off and done two different bands. So it really looked for a time like we might have two hop form festivals, each headlined by a different UB40. But that wasn't in 2016. But that second to Ed Sheeran getting stabbed in the face as my favourite stories in CMU history. You mentioned that we had more politics to come up in this section. And also, we've already discussed the EU and Brexit referendum stuff.
Yeah. Now, I think this might still be my favourite story. I think it would be more clearly my favourite story had the vote gone slightly differently, by which I mean completely differently.
So this was, yes, so this story sort of occurred in the run-up to the EU referendum when you were still being a smug London-focused, it'll be Remain.
Part of the media elite, which I definitely am not.
But yes, with hindsight, given that you're just out of touch, maybe not so amusing. But in the run-up to the EU referendum, when we still didn't know the way the vote was going to go, this event was announced, which initially was positioned, old time people might remember the old Rock the Vote movement, which was where sort of pop stars or DJs or whatever encourage young people to vote. And the whole point about Rock the Vote and the various different sort of spin-off campaigns is it's non-partisan. So it's not pop stars saying to young people, vote for Labour, vote for Conservative, whatever. It's simply trying to get, you know, because young people don't, I mean, one of the reasons why the EU referendum went the way it went is because old people vote, young people don't.
Yeah.
And so it's a very admirable campaign that you get pop stars or people who are popular with young people to just say to those people who are of an age where they can vote, whatever you do, vote. And so you have these events and campaigns. And so when Bpop Live was first announced, it was implied that that's what it was going to be.
Yeah.
Big referendum coming up. We don't think young people are going to vote. So we're going to do a big event to encourage the kids to vote.
Yeah, so they had, I mean, it was a impressive lineup. It was going to be held at the Genting Arena in Birmingham. They had Sigma headline. They had Ella Eyre. Pixie Lott was rumoured. DJ Luck and MC Neat. Fats and Small. I mean, you know, tails off, but you've got to have a hierarchy in these things, haven't you? And the thing with it was, although it had been positioned as sort of a Rock the Vote type of thing, the speakers at it, the political speakers, were all on the Leave side. It was endorsed by the Leave EU campaign, and it was funded by the man funding the Leave EU campaign. So it was kind of a bit Leave-y. And as a result, all the acts quit the show.
So it became apparent, although at this point Bpop Live was still insisting that they were a non-partisan event that just happened to have the support of various organisations supporting the Leave vote, once it became clear, yeah, this seems to be a big event, it's not at telling young people to vote, it's telling young people to vote Leave, every single artist pulled out. But the organisers, they weren't bothered by the fact that it turned out that British pop stars were either very pro-Remain or wanting to be a bit non-committal on all of this. But they were not put off. They came back and they said, doesn't matter that everyone's pulled out. This event is still non-partisan, still going ahead. Wait till you see the replacement artists that we've got lined up.
So they, round two, they got two members of Five, E17, Alicia Dixon, and Sister Sledge.
So there's some value in that. Mm. Although, remember, this was meant to be convincing young people to vote, and that's a little bit of a retro lineup. Even if you are a fan of Sister Sledge, and why not, you can't really think that many first-time voters are going to be coming along to an event on the back of Sister Sledge, E17 and two-fifths of Five.
Yes, and the reason all the previous artists had pulled out was because they hadn't been made aware of exactly what the event was, and they were like, hey, we're not going to be used for a political campaign, that's not what we're about, so you can all piss off, basically. And then the same thing happened again. Once the lineup was announced, the journalists all got on the phone to the artists and they all went, what? No. And pulled out. And it was within 24 hours, they went, once again, had no artists. But the show must go on.
And so the official line was, it's still a non-partisan event, and wait till you hear our third lineup.
So imagine, we were discussing acts featuring most of the members of a band but not having the rights to the name. The headliner of the final iteration was formerly of Bucks Fizz.
So that's
legally what you must call them.
The members of the classic lineup of Bucks Fizz, but who no longer have the rights to the name, but who are still singing that song they had. Well, that was the irony, wasn't it? Because obviously they're famous for their Eurovision.
Yeah.
Their Eurovision hit.
Yeah.
And now they were headline. And by this point, no artist... This had got a lot of press by this point. No artist could honestly say, oh, we didn't realise that this event seemed to be skewing towards the Leave campaign. So,
But they also... They didn't just have formerly of Bucks Fizz.
No.
They also had Europe's premier Elvis impersonator.
So quite the lineup.
Quite a lineup for a 15,000 seat arena, of which they apparently, I think they sold 1,000 tickets, although there was some heavy discounting going on and a lot of giving them away for free. And sadly, the event did not go ahead.
Well, by this point, it had been pushed back, hasn't it? Because it was meant to be happening before the deadline to register to vote. Because the whole point was to persuade young people to vote, and stage one of voting is making sure you're registered to vote. Then it got pushed back beyond the deadline. And then I think eventually it was going to be... Was it going to be after the vote? It was going to be a sort of celebration that was... Anyway, in the end, it did not happen. And that was all hilarious until we all woke up on the Friday morning after the referendum. And it turned out that they had the last laugh.
However, I think all through this, we said, look, these are the people who want you to vote for Leave. And look at how good they are at organising things. And if there's been one thing we've seen since then, it's that the people who want to leave
don't have a
are
plan.
Not very good at organising things, not least leaving the European Union.
Yes, it was a nice metaphor is what you're saying.
Yeah.
A bold ambition with no actual plan of action. And it should be said that in the final stages of this debacle, the people organising it became a little bit more upfront about the fact that it was being entirely paid for by the Leave campaign, and it was basically a Leave campaign event. But it was a Leave campaign event that never happened. Hey, maybe Brexit will never happen.
Maybe.
Maybe there's an even bigger metaphor here. So this ends our top five, but they were in no particular order, but maybe they were funny, amusing things that happened in music this year. So 2017, you're going to have to beat having pop stars shouting at their fans, pop stars being stabbed in the face, old pop groups not being able to agree, mad political events that don't happen, and you're going to, hey, Nobel committee, who could you give the literature prize to that would result in more amusing events than Bob Dylan.
And finally, on this bumper edition...
It is a bumper edition.
...podcast.
We should have said this at the start, that you've got like a month to listen to this podcast. I mean, not quite, but you've got several weeks to listen to this podcast. So if you've been listening to it all the way through in one sitting and not putting some back for early Jan, well done.
Yeah.
Because this has proven to be a bumper edition. But you know
what? We had a whole year to squeeze into it.
We did. We did have to squeeze in an entire year of events in the music industry.
I mean, if anything, I mean, normally we talk about just a week for an hour.
Yes, so it should be 52 hours.
Yeah.
So we're doing very well. So,
we've still got a section to go. We could.
Well, it's not unknown once I start talking about the safe harbours debate. Just. Not quite 50 hours.
I think 50 hours would be something, or 51 hours would be something of a record for you, even you.
But it's not unknown for me to have a lot to say about this. Safe harbours!
Safe harbours have been a thing this year, and many other years, but particularly this year.
So, this is the element of copyright law. Oh, I've described safe harbours many times. I've bored even myself.
Don't say that. We want people to listen for another 50 hours.
It's the element of copyright law that says that internet companies, when they provide services to people, whether that be server space or internet access or whatever, when they provide internet services to other people, and then those other people use those internet services to infringe copyright, to distribute copyright material without permission, you can't sue the service provider. You can go and find the individual and sue them for copyright infringement, but they probably don't have any money, and there's no point suing poor people. But you can't go after the internet service provider or the server hosting company or whoever else, because although they have been involved in the infringement, and in many cases they've actually hosted the infringing content on their servers, they are protected by these things called safe harbors. And what the law says is, providing the service provider has a system in place whereby a rights owner can go and say, you're hosting our content without permission because the user's uploaded it, so get rid of that content, block it, delete it, remove it. Providing you have a takedown system in place, then you cannot then be sued for copyright infringement. So that's what the safe harbors say. They date from the 1990s, sort of the early days of mainstream usage of the internet. The reason why they've been such a big debate in the music industry in the last couple of years is because it is because of safe harbors that YouTube and others, but mainly YouTube, can operate what I call an opt-out rather than an opt-in streaming service.
Yes, and as we get onto this, does sound, as you explained, although you tried very hard, does sound quite boring.
Yes.
However, like a lot of things that sound very boring, they're actually quite interesting. And also, they're almost intentionally boring so that you don't pay attention to them. And actually, they have very big implications and effects on how not only business is done, but how people make money. And not just, you know, the little people, in this case, the musicians and the songwriters who are creating music.
Indeed. And as a result of that, this slightly dull copyright story has resulted in lots of very famous pop stars getting very angry and writing opinion editorials and signing letters and all of that stuff this year. So YouTube has, as I say, an opt-out rather than an opt-in streaming service. So if you're a Spotify or an Apple Music or any of those services and you need music, because that's what you do, you go to the record companies and you do a deal, and the record company says, well, this is our deal, and you say, well, can we change this, can we change that, and you do your negotiations and you reach an agreement, or you don't. And if you don't reach an agreement, then the label can say, well, all right then, we won't do business, you just be a streaming service without our content. Or you do a deal, and then the record company provides all their content to the service and everyone's happy and the deal goes into action, the money flows, blah blah blah. Okay, that's how it works. However, YouTube doesn't need your content because YouTube's users are constantly uploading content that they've nabbed off the TV, or they've ripped it, or they've got it from somewhere. And so YouTube is full of music content. Some of that is actual music videos. Some of it is audio with a slideshow or a static image. Some of it obviously is music that's then synced into user-generated content or YouTuber content. So there's a lot of content sitting on YouTube, which means that when YouTube goes to the music industry to try and get licensing deals because it wants to be a player in music, YouTube has a much stronger negotiating hand than the other services. Because if YouTube goes in and has a deal with a major record company and the major record company isn't happy with the deal that YouTube is proposing, with Spotify, if it's not happy with the deal that Spotify is proposing, then the label can say, well, we won't do the deal, you can't have our content. Okay, and if you think you can exist without our content, then whatever, but we suspect you can't. So therefore, we've got a strong negotiating hand here. So we're going to force all these terms in there, which you're not going to like, but you're going to have to accept.
You have no choice.
And it's to our advantage. And we have these minimum guarantees in the contract, which means that whatever happens, we're going to earn good money in the short term beyond the revenue share in the long term. However, if a label says to YouTube, nope, we're not doing the deal, so you can't have our content, YouTube can say, well, we've already got your content because our users have uploaded it. We are obliged to remove that content if you inform us of it because of the takedown system element of the safe harbors. But we do that because we have this system called Content ID. So you can't sue us for having your content because we are protected by the safe harbors. It's our users who uploaded it. We're providing you with a takedown system. And if you don't want to be on our platform, then take the content down. But although Content ID is a great system, it's not perfect by any means. And so if you're a record company that has sound recordings, let alone if you're a publisher who has songs, because Content ID generally is better at spotting recordings than songs. So Content ID is a system that, in theory, once you've logged your recording with Content ID, the system should automatically spot people uploading it. And the clever bit, it should even recognise the song if someone does a new version of your song. But it's not perfect. There are workarounds. So basically you upload the recording at 98% speed, and so then it may not get picked up by Content ID. So the system's not perfect. So if you were a major record company and you wanted all of your music removed from YouTube in one go, you would, A, have to employ a bunch of people to use Content ID to its fullest effect. And realistically, you'd have to have other people constantly doing metadata searches on the YouTube platform, looking for content that Content ID has missed, and then manually requesting that be taken down through the system. So that is an effort. So basically what YouTube can sort of say to the record companies is, well, either you do the deal on these terms, and basically the YouTube deal is rev share just like everybody else, but without the minimum guarantees. Do the deal that we've put on the table, or by all means, try removing your content off our platform. But every day, all over the world, thousands, hundreds of thousands, I don't know, a lot of people are going to be uploading your content, which you're going to then have to manually remove. So what that means is you won't earn anything because you're not doing business with us. Plus, you'll have to hire a load of people to keep your content off. Much easier to just sign a deal, get a share of the ad money. So now you don't have to spend any money taking the content down. I mean, you do have to keep making sure you log your content ID, but that's a lot easier. Plus, you'll get paid. You'll earn money. So you'll now have money to pay the people you have to do content ID, and you'll make a profit. That's easier, isn't it? And indeed, in the early days, the labels were like, yeah, that is easier. All right, we'll sign these deals. But of course, what the record companies don't like is as they're seeing their Spotify and Apple Music income grow, because basically more users, more streams on those platforms because of the minimum guarantees means the labels are making more money every month. Whereas on the YouTube side, they only earn when ads are sold. Doesn't matter how many users there are, doesn't matter how many streams there are, they only earn when ads are sold. And so the labels are down on YouTube because it brings in a lot less money. And certainly if you do some sums and make it on a per stream income, it's tiny income compared to Spotify and Apple Music.
And arguably for the for your average mainstream consumer who just wants a bit of music here and there, YouTube is free and a more attractive option, and you know, and it has a much higher user base. And so therefore the music industry argument is actually it's stopping the premium streaming over here from growing because it's offering too much for nothing.
So not only are we not making enough over here with the way you've structured the deal, we think that it's stopping people from joining Spotify and Apple Music over here, which is where we're really making our money. So we're not making enough money from you guys. Plus, you're making this side of the business not as big as it could and should be. So the music industry is down on YouTube for various reasons. And because of the safe harbours, YouTube has this stronger negotiating hands. So basically what the music industry wants is to get the negotiating power back so they can go into the meeting room and say, right, you will do a deal like Spotify. And if you won't do a deal like Spotify, we will tell you to remove all the content. And we need a situation where at that point, copyright law says, right, this is now you. You choose responsibility to remove this content. You can't simply say to the labels, well, here's content ID. You remove the content. You now have to take responsibility for that content. And if you don't, you can be sued for copyright infringement. So you're going to do it because otherwise massive damages in court. But it is generally thought, I mean, this varies from country to country on exactly how you interpret the safe harbours, but it is generally assumed that YouTube does have safe harbour protection. In the US, it comes from the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. In Europe, it comes from European Directive. Other countries also have safe harbour rules in their copyright or internet legislation. It's generally felt that in most countries, YouTube is protected by the safe harbour, which means that the record companies can't do that big demand, which means that they have to accept these terms that they don't like, and so on and so forth. And this has been brewing for a while now. And it was a few years ago, wasn't it? It used to be that Google search we hate because you don't delist the Pirate Bay and Kick-Ass, but YouTube, great marketing channel, bit of ad income, lovely.
Yeah.
And then a few years ago, basically once downloads started to go down, because in the early days of YouTube, it was like, well, we get a little bit of money, it's a marketing platform, and really people want downloads, so they'll watch our videos on YouTube, and then we can send them down to iTunes, so it's a marketing platform and it sells the iTunes download. iTunes then started to go into decline, and it was like, okay, what are we selling now? We're not selling downloads, we're selling Spotify and Apple Music. Well, not at that point Apple Music, but Spotify. But why are people going to go to Spotify when basically they're already getting that experience on YouTube? And so the music industry started to fall out with YouTube. YouTube became the bad boy. And then actually it was 2015, really, when the record industry started to reinvent that. Rather than being just, oh, YouTube, we don't like YouTube, started to reinvent it with, well, they came up with the value gap, didn't they?
Yes.
The big bad value gap. And they explicitly started to say, the real problem is this safe harbour law. If we could just get the safe harbours reformed. They don't want to get rid of the safe harbours. They have no problem with ISPs or server hosting companies from having this protection.
But they don't want YouTube covered by it.
They feel that a service that has a consumer-facing media curated platform that then pulls its content from user uploads, that shouldn't be covered by safe harbours. The argument is that when the safe harbours were written in the 1990s, no one ever anticipated a YouTube-type service having the protection. And they're right, because nobody in the 1990s ever anticipated a service like YouTube from existing. So on that level, they are right to say that. And so they would like the safe harbours rewritten to basically say, safe harbours apply, blah, blah, blah. Oh, except for, well, there's the challenge. How do you write some work? You can't put YouTube into law. So how do you write a little bit of legislation that means a YouTube-type service doesn't get safe harbour protection, but you don't have unintended consequences where a whole load of other sites that actually you don't mind about, bloggers who are bigging up your music, who you like, aren't suddenly then caught up in the revamp of safe harbour law. So this has been brewing for a while. The reason why it's been big news this year, twofold. Well, threefold in that the record industry gets ever more vocal on this.
Yes.
But in Europe, they've got this thing called the digital single market that's been on the agenda for a while now. But that resulted this year in a new draft copyright directive. So all the copyright systems in Europe are united for European law. We've got a draft copyright directive that came out earlier this year, which is proposing to introduce reforms into copyright law from a digital perspective, because it's all coming as part of a big digital initiative. And so that has proposed safe harbour reform in it. So in Europe, the safe harbour conversation all became about, first of all, lobbying to get safe harbours into the directive. And to be fair to the record industry, initial papers published by the European Commission on copyright review always put safe harbours right down the bottom as if it was a real afterthought. But when the directive was published, there it is. There is an article in the directive about safe harbours. Since then, the conversation has been, does it? I mean, it's a bit wishy-washy at the moment. It's not really. Well, neither the record industry nor YouTube were happy with it.
No.
So make of that what you will. But the lobbying continues because obviously the directive is currently a draft, will go before the European Council and the European Parliament next year. So that's what's happening in Europe. Meanwhile, over in the US, the US Copyright Office instigated a review of safe harbours. So that's not Congress. It's not actually new legislation on the table. But the Copyright Office, which is part of the Library of Congress, went out there and started questioning people and getting input on safe harbours. And so that meant that to that point, most of the debate had been in Europe as the European Copyright Review got underway. Suddenly, the American music industry were rallying on safe harbours, and that's where you really started to see big name artists turn out.
Yes. And of course, in the middle of that, a couple of things have happened. One is that the leadership at the Copyright Office was changed, which has been somewhat controversial, with some accusations that the new boss of that has been brought in because she's more tech friendly.
Yes.
And so less music industry friendly. And of course, the other thing that's happened is Donald Trump has somehow won an election to become the president of the United States of America. And who knows what he thinks or will do on this subject, which
yes,
has resulted in a lot of letter writing.
It has. So the Copyright Office review took place. They actually haven't published any findings on that. They just started a second round of the review. So it's all going round in a circle again. So as you say, the top person in the Copyright Office was called the Register of Copyrights. She was basically fired. Her boss at the Library of Congress has had links to like Google in the past. So there's now a second phase of the review, and the old boss of the Copyright Office was seen as being very friendly to the creative
yes,
community. So there's a conspiracy theory that now there's a second stage of the review. So when that review finally reports, it may not be as sympathetic to the creative community as was hoped on the safe harbour issue. Meanwhile, over here, yes, what about Donald Trump? And obviously, part of the Trump agenda is taking on the sinister lobbying machine in Washington. It has to be said, the tech lobby has traditionally enjoyed more power in Washington than the entertainment industry. I mean, even though obviously the music industry and the movie industry are big in the US, but when it comes to lobbying activity in Washington, the tech industry has a huge lobbying machine there. Someone once said to me that they'd done some maths and they thought that Google alone have more retained lobbyists in Washington than the entire music industry. So there is a feeling that the tech lobby is very strong in Washington. Certainly the Obama administration has generally been very sympathetic to the tech lobby, recognizing tech's a big part of the American economy. So therefore, some of the music community have been going to Trump and saying, well, if you want to take on the big bad lobby machine in Washington, take on the tech lobby, get rid of the safe harbors, help us in the creative community. And as you say, there have been various open letters written by the music industry to that effect. Although, of course, there is the slight downside that in the run-up to the presidential election, pretty much everybody in the music community went to great lengths to encourage the American people to vote for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And with the exception of, well, obviously Kanye West has since said, A, he would have voted for Donald Trump had he bothered to vote. And then obviously he then went to have a little meeting with the new president in Trump Tower. So perhaps Kanye can start lobbying on this. You reckon Azealia Banks had said something?
Well, she was pro Trump and then anti-Trump and then pro-Trump again. And then there's been, I mean, there are a few other people, but not a great many musicians came out in favour of Trump. And then, of course, there's been the whole ongoing thing of him really struggling to get anyone to agree to perform at his big inauguration party in January. That's become a big story.
So it remains unknown as to what Trump's presidency will mean for the music industry's campaign on this issue. The open letters that have been published, I mean, they cover various... There are other things that the music industry would like changed in terms of copyright law and similar in the US. But safe harbours was very much there in at the top of the letter saying, A, whatever you do, don't expand the safe harbours, because that might be what the tech lobby is asking for. And actually, please, will you revise safe harbours in American law so to mean that services like YouTube will no longer be protected. So as we head into 2017, in Europe, it's the European Copyright Directive. As I say, safe harbours are in there, so that is an achievement on the record industry's part.
Yeah, especially as that was something it kind of looked like they weren't going to manage to get.
No, it looked like they were going to be completely ignored. It is in there. I think how it is currently written, although YouTube expressed concern about how it's currently written, so it suggests that their lawyers aren't completely clear on this, but I think there's enough wiggle room in the way it's currently written that YouTube could say, we're sort of already compliant with that, because it talks about that there's an obligation to provide tools to help manage content. Well, they do that. There's an obligation to have licensing conversations with the industry. Well, they do that. So I think there's enough wiggle room in there as it's currently written that YouTube could turn around and say, well, we already comply with this. So obviously the record industry is busy lobbying to try and get the writing tightened up. Meanwhile, Google, etc. are busy trying to get it loosened. So it'll be interesting to see what the final line is like. From a UK perspective, who knows whether or not this directive will actually become UK law, because it sort of depends on the timing. It looks like it probably will, because on the current, even best case scenario, Brexit timeline, it probably will be UK law. But beyond the UK, what will the final draft in Europe be? What will it mean? I suspect that it will still have enough ambiguity that it will then, let's say it takes a year to actually become law in the European countries. So we're now looking at 2019, probably 2018 at the earliest. There probably then needs to be a test case in a court somewhere, which might then have to go to the European. So probably you're looking 2 to 3 years to get it actually in the law, then 2 to 3 years to test it in court. So probably you're looking at 2020, 2021.
And by which time YouTube will be long gone.
Certainly the streaming market. If you think everything that's happened in the last 5-6 years in digital music, where the hell are we going to be in 5-6 years' time?
And perhaps, it will be the case, as often happens with things like this, actually, by the time it comes to it, doesn't matter anymore.
Everyone's over it.
Yeah.
Everyone's learned. And I mean, there is part of me that feels that there are arguments on both sides, and I am sympathetic to both sets of arguments. The music industry learned to live with file sharing. File sharing never went away, okay? But iTunes boomed, the streaming services emerged. It looked like actually the record industry could go into revival. A few anti-piracy things did come along, like web blocking, but file sharing still goes on and everyone learned to live with it. And I think ultimately people will learn to live with YouTube once the Spotify's and Apple Music's have enough users that they are viable businesses long term. So we'll see. Meanwhile, back in the US, it was generally felt that the chances of getting reform in the US were very low. It wasn't actual legislation in Congress. It was just a review and the tech lobbies. And it's not just Google and YouTube, remember. I mean, Facebook.
Yes. Which that's sort of the elephant in the room.
And there are some artists now who are sort of saying, yeah, we've lost our voices shouting about YouTube so much, but at least they have licensing deals. We are bringing in a bit of, we might not be happy with the money.
Yeah.
But we're making some money.
Whereas obviously Facebook has been really ramping up its video stuff throughout 2016. And no licenses.
And it has its own version of Content ID going on in the background, and there is talk of licensing being applied to that. But, I mean, the service is gaining rapid momentum. There are some people now, we're watching a lot more video on Facebook than there are on YouTube. So, yes, what about Facebook? But that means when it comes to the lobbying effort in Washington, it isn't just Google. It is Facebook and probably Twitter and probably Snapchat will be in there saying we need to keep it as it is, innovation, blah, 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 all the stuff that they always say. So I think most people in the music industry would probably not say this necessarily on the record, but the people I talk to who are involved in the lobbying activity are not hugely optimistic about the US, but think that they potentially can get something in place in Europe Although, as I say, I then add a whole load of pessimism and doom and gloom on top of that. Having said that, I mean, once Trump's in the White House, who knows? It may be that suddenly next February, a tweet lands at 3 o'clock in the morning saying, safe harbours have changed, YouTube's shutting down tomorrow. And it has to be said, after this year.
would that be surprising?
I don't think
nothing is surprising anymore.
Nothing is surprising anymore. But what we do know for certain is that the whole safe harbours debate is going to continue for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
I know it might feel like this podcast is going to continue for the foreseeable future, but it's not.
It's not. That's it. It's done. You've made it. Not only through this podcast, but also through 2016.
And well done, because a lot of people didn't.
Yeah.
We've not paid tribute to the many artists who passed this year. Because
there really isn't time.
There isn't time. There's too long a list. And also plenty of other media are doing that over the Christmas break. But I would just say as an aside, copyright in songs lasts for the life of the creator and then another 70 years. Mm-hmm. And then the copyrights go public domain. They come out of copyright on the 1st of January, the year after the 70 years expires. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Think of the repertoire that's going to become public domain on the 1st of January. Now, let's do the maths here. 2087.
Yeah.
There's going to be a lot of really good public domain songs available in 2087.
Some of you will probably be around then, so look forward to that.
Yeah.
That's something to look forward to. 2087.
Yeah. that's the silver lining, people. If you've been looking for the silver lining for 2016, I've found it.
It's in 2087.
But it's not coming until 2087. So by which point, we might be about to Brexit. So as we Brexit, at least all that music will become public domain.
But yes, that really is it. We are done. There's just the formalities of Christmas and New Year to go, of which you should have merry and happy one, respectively. Those are the words that go with each. While we're away...
Even though, don't people get more merry at New Year?
I think that is a debate for another time. Right. Maybe we'll do a podcast on just that subject.
Okay, I look forward to it.
While we're away, there are things you can do. You could listen to some of our playlists on Spotify, CMUHQ. Just put that in the search box, you'll find them all. They're great, full of really top-notch music. You could listen to this podcast on Spotify if you like. You could subscribe to it in many places. iTunes, SoundCloud. It's a thing we met. As long as SoundCloud sticks around, you'll be able to subscribe to our podcast. Mixcloud, that's not you. We're not on YouTube.
No, we're not.
No.
Audio Boom and any podcast app of your choosing. Other things you could do, you could become a premium CMU subscriber. It's only 60 quid or 30 quid for 6 months, 60 quid for the year. Get access to our weekly news digest and the CMU Trends articles. So if you really want to dig deep into what's happening in the music industry, become a premium subscriber. We've also got lots of CMU Insights events coming up in the new year. We've got our seminars program. We've got our Music Rights Masterclass. Hey, if you were in any way, and who wouldn't be? If that little safe harbours conversation was like that just wasn't enough, then come to our Music Rights Developments. That's not what it's called. I can't remember what it's called. Our Music Rights Masterclass that's happening in the new year. We've also got CMU DIY coming back with Urban Development in the new year. I'm doing a couple of sessions at the Output event in Belfast, and we're doing some training courses for the first time in Dublin with IMRO, which is the collecting society in Ireland. There's loads of stuff coming up. Book into all of those things.
And join us again on the podcast sometime in January 2017.
We reckon the second Friday of January 2017.
Yes, that is what we reckon, isn't it?
So that's probably now. This podcast has been so long. It probably is about to start. Although that would mean that we would now have to, having done this podcast, record that podcast. So let's hope that isn't what's happening.
I'm not doing it. I refuse.
So have a great Christmas. And although there's no CMU Daily over the festive period, if there are big stories breaking, we will report on them on the website. So follow us on the socials and we'll update you on that.
Yes, at CMU on Twitter and I think CMUHQ on Facebook. Well, if you search Complete Music Update, you will find us there. That's... As I've said several times now, that is it.
But that really is it.
Yes.
Is it it?
Well, not really, because there's still a little bit to
go. There's a little formality.
Then after this bit, we'll be done. The CMU podcast is presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Petey, who we should say thank you to for editing the podcast and making it sound good throughout the year, and particularly this one, because it's so flipping long.
And if you think that it's long when you're listening to it, you should hear the unedited version. Thanks, Matt Petey.
Thanks. And for more on CMU...
This is really it now.
Go to completemusicupdate.com. That's it. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Goodbye.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Hello. Have you guys got keys?
No, we haven't.
No, we're just finishing. Okay. That took a lot longer than we expected.
No problem at all. Right.
But we'll be out in a minute.
Okay.